מה שלומך? All right. This evening we'll begin. Our brother Courtney left his siddur at home, so we'll miss our beautiful music. You have to deal with my butchy Hebrew, so. Let us begin. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Ha'alam Asher Kidishanu B'Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu Al Devrei Torah. Blessed are you, Adonai, our God, King of the Universe, who has sanctified us with His commandments and has commanded us concerning the words and the matters of Torah. Amen. Amen. All right. I trust everyone has a sheet. Is that correct? All right. We'll begin the way we normally do. We'll look at our weekly Hebrew lesson, which again is, so far, has essentially either been the first verse of the parashat or the first part of the verse of the parashat. I'll read it, then I'll translate it, and if there are any little additional commentary, I might add it. And maybe illuminate some of the Hebrew there for you. And then we'll say it together, and then we'll dive into the parashat. So, Vayachi Yaakov Be'eretz Mitzrayim Shva Esrei Shana. Okay, Vayachi, there we go. We have that beginning. What's it beginning with?
And
the Vav. So, there you go. That's the Hebrew word for and. Okay, so as Hebrew likes to do, it likes to begin sentences with and. So, Vayechi, that's third person, that's, and he lived. Now, Hebrew likes to go verb-subject, where we go subject-verb. Hebrew can do it the other way, but it likes to do verb-subject. So we've got, and he lived. The subject may stay he, but we're going to look for that subject. And then, well, this is good Hebrew. Yaakov. Who's Yaakov? What's that? That's Jacob. So there's our subject. So, and Jacob lived by Eretz. There we have the preposition ba. Okay, so that's one of its meanings is in. And then Eretz is land. So, and Jacob lived in the land, in the land. Mitzrayim, that's Egypt. That's the Hebrew word for Egypt. And we talked, I believe, last week, kind of deals with constriction and so forth. And then we have Shiva, 7, Esrei, 10, so you have 7 plus 10, basically, which is 17. So Shiva Esrei is 17. Shana, that's years, okay, like Rosh Hashanah. Hashana is the year. Rosh is the head, beginning. Rosh Hashana. So Shana is year. So, and Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. Okay, so let us read this together. Ready? Vayahi Yaakov Ba'eretz Mitzrayim Shva Esrei Shana. Okay, very good. And we'll come back a little bit later to 17. Again, that's actually quite significant. This parashat's also unique in the structure of the Torah, because the Torah and its manuscripts, all of the parashats are separated. Visually, you could tell where a parashat ended and where the next one began, because there's, for the scribes, a preset number of spaces and so forth. This is the only parashat that doesn't do this. It runs right with the previous one. So there's some fodder there, but we won't go into it. I'll just point that out for this time through the parashat. So let's look here. A company of peoples. Here we're coming in this parashat to the conclusion of Bereshit, the book of Genesis, the book of the beginnings. And we come to the final days of Jacob's life and his passing of the covenant blessings to his sons. And we've seen this kind of ceremony before. Abraham passed it to Isaac. Isaac passes it to Jacob. And now we're coming to this point where Jacob is going to pass along the covenantal blessings to his descendants. Now someone has come and told Joseph that his father was ill. And by the way, law of firsts. What's the law of firsts in the Torah? Hebrew minds, what's that? What's the law of firsts? First time something occurs in the Torah, whether it be a word, again, unless it's and or in and so forth. First time a word occurs, or first time something thematically occurs, it's a big deal. This is the first time illness is mentioned. Okay, this is the first time illness is mentioned in the Torah. So Joseph goes to his father, and he takes along his sons Manasseh and Ephraim. And when bedridden Jacob is aware that Joseph has arrived, he gathers his strength, and he sits up in bed. And so here again, we're witnessing the scarlet thread of redemption. This is a theme that we started talking about from the get-go in Bereshit. This idea that running throughout all of the Torah is this idea of redemption through the seed, through the Messiah. Mm-hmm. And the hint of the seed. And the passing of the covenant blessings from one generation to another. And so the first thing Jacob does is he recounts the blessings of the covenant confirmed to him by the Almighty. The promise initially given to Abraham and passed on to his son, Isaac, they're confirmed in Jacob as well. In Genesis 28, verse 3, it says, "May God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you that you may become a company of peoples." Then the next generation, Genesis 35, it's a very similar blessing, but literally reads, "that you may become a company of nations," goyim. And then in our text this week, Genesis 48:4, "I will make you into a company of peoples." So we're seeing the global implications of this covenant. And again, that's been the theme with this covenant, that though it's specifically with Abraham and then with Isaac and then with Jacob, Israel, that it goes through, but it's to go to the nations. So how is all of this going to be accomplished? How is Jacob going to be made into a kahilah, a congregation of peoples? The answer is in that the final blessing that was originally given to Abraham, Genesis 12, verse 3, "In you all the families of the earth will be blessed." So here what we see again in seed form is the method of blessing that God has determined. That is, that the nations will not be blessed apart from Israel. Okay, that's an important theme going through here. The nations are to be blessed, and they are to have salvation. They are to have all these wonderful things, but not apart from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Not apart from Israel. Okay, the nations are blessed by joining Israel. And Rav Shaul, who's Rav Shaul? Yeah, you might know him as the Apostle St. Paul, but nowhere does the New Testament actually tell us of his name change, by the way. Rav Shaul, Rabbi Shaul. This is his point in Ephesians 3 when he writes that God had revealed his plan, that the nations would be drawn into the covenant by faith, and that they would be blessed as, quote, "fellow heirs and fellow members of the body and fellow partakers of the promise of Yeshua HaMashiach," Ephesians 3:6. God promised blessings upon all the families of the earth, but this would be fulfilled only insofar as they shared in the covenantal blessings promised to Abraham. And so this is the way in which Jacob would become a congregation of people, or a congregation of nations, by them joining into the faith and the covenant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now the sons of Joseph become the sons of Jacob. Sent out a little teaser on email and on the Facebook page. How many sons did Jacob have? What's going to be the typical answer? 12. And you'd probably get that correct at a trivia night, unless I was there and I'd have to object. when I answer 14 and they give me the X and I have to go and defend my cause. Jacob has 14 sons, okay? And we're going to find out how. Okay, we have a very moving scene in this week's parashat. Aged Jacob, he's very close to death. Yet in these final days, he's going to bestow immense proportions upon the sons of Joseph. And I quote from the text. Jacob says, "Now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt, they're born among the nations." Okay, and we talked about the whole implications of Joseph marrying a foreign wife and what all of that was the fractal of. "Before I came to you in Egypt, but they are mine," Jacob says. "Ephraim and Manasseh will be mine, just as Reuben and Simeon are." And this is Jacob. Now Jacob, with his dim eyesight, asked that Ephraim and Manasseh be brought to him and brought to his bedside, and then he invites Manasseh and Ephraim to be placed upon his knees. Bereshit 48, verse 12. Now you may think, oh, this is a nice little scene. Grandpa, he hasn't seen these two grandchildren. They were born in Egypt to a foreign wife, and he's in his latter days, and so he wants to get to know them, and he pops them up on his knees like Santa Claus. But that's not what's going on here. A legal interaction is going on here. This is more than a close family moment. It's a legal action. In the ancient Near East, adoption was demonstrated by placing a child upon one's knee. And consider also how beautifully this fits in with the context of what Jacob has just said. "You will be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are mine." Okay, and then he has him sit on his knees. So you have an adoption ceremony going on. And you know what? You've already encountered this in the Torah. You've already read about an adoption in the Torah through the sitting on of the knees. Okay? When a concubine gave birth to a child, the child might be reckoned as the adopted and therefore the legal child of the wife, not the concubine. This was the case with Bilhah. There, Rivka. Who's Rivka?
Rebecca,
that's her Hebrew name. She instructs Jacob in Genesis chapter 30, verse 3. "Here is my handmaid Bilhah. Go into her that she may bear on my knees, that through her I might have children." To bear on knees is legal language widely attested in the ancient Near East as the legitimation of adoption. We have this in archaeology and extra-biblical accounts. And so, on my knees, when Rivka says that, she's saying, "Go and have a baby with Bilhah so that I might adopt them." And then they would be legally my children. And so you've already encountered this language. So here is an amazing aspect of the parashat this week. Jacob legally adopts the sons of Joseph. Born from an Egyptian mother, being of the nations, they now gain full equal status through adoption by Israel. Now, are the fractals going off here, folks? What is one of Rav Shaul's greatest metaphors of salvation in his epistles? We are adopted. Adoption. Where did Paul get that? I don't know. Okay? A child of the nations being adopted and thus becoming part of Israel and thus becoming heirs to all of the covenant blessings and all the rights and privileges thereof. This is no wonder the Apostle Paul uses the adoption metaphor. Also, note here also, who's Jacob's favorite son, the original favorite son? Joseph. Well, now that Joseph's two sons are legally Jacob's sons, they're going to get blessings from Jacob, inheritance and so forth. So who gets triple blessings in essence? Joseph. Okay, so beautiful how Jacob also works that out. Now, the firstborn, and here we go again, another fractal. What have we learned about firstborn so far? What are they pretty much never? They're pretty much never firstborn. Okay. There is the physical firstborn, you know, and that's what we think of in the Western or in the Peshat, literally the first one born. But then there's also the spiritual firstborn, okay? Like Isaac gets described as this unique begotten son and so forth, but he's not the first son, technically, you know, in the technical sense of the word. But in another sense, he is. Jacob and Esau, okay? And other examples. So the blessings bestowed upon Ephraim and Manasseh contains another important revelation. It appears at first reading that Jacob's all mixed up about which of the sons is the firstborn. When Joseph situates his sons before Jacob in order to receive his final blessing, he arranges them in their natural order. Ephraim is adjacent to Jacob's left hand. Manasseh stands on his right. The firstborn should receive the blessing of the right hand, the symbol of power and authority, but then Jacob crosses his hands, putting his right upon Ephraim and his left upon Manasseh. Jacob purposely gives the blessing of the firstborn to the younger of the two. And Joseph presumes that his aged father has simply made a mistake. Perhaps he's got some failing eyesight. He's unable to distinguish between the two. So Joseph protests and he moves to rearrange the hands of his father. But Jacob wasn't confused. He intended to give the blessing of the firstborn to the younger son. And so here we go again, right? Okay, the younger son getting the firstborn blessing. The blessing of the younger over the older is following a consistent pattern, dare we say, a fractal throughout the Genesis narrative. Isaac, the second son of Abraham, is the chosen one, and it is so to Jacob and not Esau that the covenant is passed. And there is an important theological point that's kind of being emphasized here, and that is that the covenantal blessings don't come purely because of natural descent, but they come essentially by grace and God's choosing, His sovereignty, what we would call in the church sola gratia. Okay, that it's ultimately God who's in charge. Okay, Jacob I've loved, Esau I've despised, and so forth. So it's not just the natural order of things. It's God's choosing. Now, there are three phrases in the blessing, Jacob's blessing, that he gives to these lads. He describes God in three ways. One is the God before whom my father Abraham and Isaac walked. And you may recall, we talked about that phrase, walking with God, when we covered that parashah. Then the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day. So the shepherd motif, the shepherd fractal, is found pretty early on. And then, there it is again that we've talked about, he refers to the angel who has redeemed me from all evil. Malach. Remember when we had our discussion about angels? I told you to get rid of that idea that they're fat little kids with wings, or that they're beautiful, ornate, glowing boys and girls, men and women, that they're purely spiritual beings and so forth. But that's not the Torah's idea of an angel. And so this is another classic case. Now, this first designation highlights the fact that the covenant made initially with Abraham was passed to Isaac and then to Jacob, and that they walked. They had the halacha. In the context of covenant renewal, Abraham is admonished to walk before me and be blameless in Genesis 17. Isaac also walks before God, and Jacob's way of confirming that covenant was passed on to him. The second designation, Jacob confesses that he likewise has become the recipient of the covenant of Abraham, just as God has been his shepherd. God had protected him, God had led him, God had matured him, God had fulfilled his word of promise to him. Moreover, in the ancient Near East, a king was often known to be the shepherd of his people. And so Jacob's description of God as his shepherd may also highlight the fact that Jacob viewed God as the great king who had entered into an eternal covenant and a promise with Jacob as his vassal, his servant. So this is very contextual, fits very much in with the ancient Near East, making sense. But the third designation may seem surprising. Jacob evokes the blessing of God upon Joseph, represented by his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And he includes the angel, the malach, the messenger. And he does so in a way that attributes divine qualities to this malach. This is an obvious reference to which malach do you think he's referring to here? Sorry. What's an important angel in Jacob's life? Happened at Beit El. Yeah, the one he wrestled with at Beit El, Genesis 32. He's the one who changed Jacob's name to Israel. And then, of course, during that parashat, we spent some time breaking down the name Israel and what it meant. And it was here that Jacob realized that he had seen God panim et panim, face to face, and yet lived. That phrase, face to face, is a very important phrase. It also occurs in the New Testament, in John's epistles. Now, more blessings are flowing. Genesis 49 continues the theme of Jacob's final blessings, and expand now to the remainder of his sons. Joseph is blessed initially through Ephraim and Manasseh, because through Joseph God has preserved the entire family. But now Jacob proceeds to give blessings upon his other sons. And these blessings are also essentially a prophecy, because as Jacob says, it tells what will, quote, befall them in the days to come. Genesis 49, verse 1. And so that's something we also need to remember about blessings and curses and the power of the tongue and the power of words. For instance, in liturgical churches like the Lutheran Church, we usually end with the Aaronic benediction. The Lord bless you and keep you, so forth. You need to be pretty aware that that isn't just routine, that we just do that every week and it gets boring. That is blessing. And blessings have the power to bestow what they are. Okay, they create, just as curses do. And so we need to be very careful with our language and the words we use. And so these blessings have the power to affect the very things they describe. And this is what Jacob says. These are the things that will befall them in the days to come. Specifically, the days to come, meaning the era and the time of Messiah. And we're not going to get into it, I guess, this year. We'll have to wait till next year. But the Torah actually reveals that Jacob saw who the Messiah was, when it was going to happen, knew every jot and tittle secret about it. And he wanted to pass that on. And just as he's about to do it, it flashes out of his mind. Okay? But he leaves little hints. Okay? He leaves little hints. Okay? In the days to come. Now, Reuben, the natural firstborn, he's the true firstborn in the literal sense that he's the firstborn, had lost his place of preeminence as a result of his serious sin. Do you remember what that was? Yeah, and that's a fractal, because that happens again and again. He attempts to usurp the role of his father, essentially tries to take Jacob's wives and so forth. And because he did this, he forever lost his privileged position. Simeon and Levi would seemingly be the next ones, okay, if we're going down the order. And they're grouped together because they instigated the treachery against the males of Shechem. Remember their brilliant plan of convincing these guys to circumcise themselves and kind of put themselves out of commission for a few days. And while they were recovering from that, they went in and slaughtered them. So like Reuben, they had forfeited the right to succeed their father as ruler of the clan. Levi would eventually be chosen as the priestly tribe because he's given the status of a servant, the servant to God's people. But he's not given the position of ruler. He's given the position of servant. And this eventually will manifest itself in the priesthood. Okay, so you're starting to see a little foreshadowing of the tribe of Levi. Then we come to Judah and King Messiah. You remember, how many messiahs are there?
Two.
Okay. Two that are one. Mashiach ben Yosef. And Mashiach ben David. So, last week in our Haftarah, we read that wonderful prophecy when the brothers Joseph and Judah will be brought together into one, and so forth. Okay? So kind of keep that kind of flowing in your mind. The blessing of Judah carries the theme of Bereshit, Genesis, to a great prophetic conclusion. Now, if we didn't know the rest of the story, and we were just reading along as we were going, we would have thought all along, who was going to be the spiritual firstborn? Joseph. Okay? He was the one that's going to get the spiritual firstborn blessing. So much has been focused on him. Remember, it even replaced, no longer is this the genealogy of Jacob, it's just Joseph. And no longer are these Jacob's sons, they're Joseph's brothers. Okay? He had done so much to save his family, to save the nations. He was favored and loved by his father over all his brothers. But ultimately, it's not in the card for him to be the king. From the beginning, the promise of the woman's seed, that scarlet thread of redemption, has lingered in our minds as we've read through Bereshit. Who would this seed be? Again, as the story unfolds, it appears that Joseph is the fulfillment of this. He does emerge as the savior of his family and his brother and the nation of Israel and the whole world. He saves the whole world in this famine. He's highly blessed by God and by his father. His character and his piety are impeccable. Hopefully all this is setting fractals off in you. But surprise, Judah is the one from which the king, the seed will come. This is Mashiach ben David. Mashiach ben David will come from Judah. And the blessing of Judah, which is in Genesis 49, 8 through 12, has long been considered a messianic prophecy, and not just by the church. The Targums. What are the Targums? Again, these are very important. What are the Targums? Yeah, this is the Aramaic paraphrase, if you will, of the Torah. And why these are important is, again, because at the time of Yeshua and even before, the synagogue service, the temple services would have been done in Hebrew, but not everyone was conversant in Hebrew, but they were in Aramaic. So when the scriptures were read in Hebrew, they were followed by an Aramaic paraphrase, not an Aramaic translation. A paraphrase, the equivalent of the Living Bible, kind of put it into the language of the people so that the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker could grasp the essence of what the Torah was for that day. So listen to the paraphrase from Targum Onkelos, which is one of the major Targums. It translates Genesis 49 verse 10 this way, or paraphrases it. The ruler shall never depart from the house of Judah, nor shall the teacher from his children's children forevermore, until Messiah comes, whose is the kingdom, and all the nations shall obey. Now, if you look at Genesis 49:10, that's not what it says. That's the paraphrase. So what is that telling us, though? And this paraphrase far existed before Yeshua's earthly ministry. What's that tell us, though, about the climate and how Jews at the time of Yeshua were understanding this passage? It was messianic, right? Okay. Other Targums follow the same pattern, specifically mentioning Messiah, which is absent, technically. Also, Qumran. What's Qumran? Yeah, Dead Sea Scrolls. You come to my class on Sunday, you'll learn that's not quite true, but we'll go with that right now. Qumran, Dead Sea Scrolls, also understood this passage messianically. From the fourth cave. Okay, and fourth cave is that really beautiful one that looks like a true, that's usually the one you see on TV, it's the fourth cave. 252, document 252, interprets Shiloh. Doesn't put Shiloh, puts the righteous Messiah. So we see that from ancient times, and well before the time of Yeshua, the blessing of Judah was known to be about Mashiach ben David. Now let's talk a little bit about Shiloh. Okay. In 49 verse 10, we have the phrase, until Shiloh comes. We've already seen how this was understood in ancient times and historically as referencing the Messiah. But there is a lot of fodder here with the word Shiloh, until Shiloh comes. What does that mean? Is Shiloh, and the sages have spent lots and lots and lots of time on this. Is Shiloh a person? Is Shiloh a place? Is Shiloh an idea or a concept? What is, who is Shiloh?
Yes.
I want to break down three of the more popular understandings, okay? These are by no means exclusive nor exhaustive. Shiloh first is a place name. And the phrase could be translated here from the Hebrew, until he comes to Shiloh. Remember the subject of the verb first. It could be, and he comes to Shiloh, or Shiloh could be the subject. You see how, remember that from Yaakov and so? So you could translate this, until he comes to Shiloh. And this has some rationale behind it. The tabernacle was destroyed at Shiloh on account of the sins of the priests. Jeremiah 7 references this. And so Shiloh took on a metaphoric meaning among the people of God. Thus Messiah will come and restore that which has been destroyed, namely the presence of God, the Shekhinah, among his people. Okay, so until he, the Messiah, comes to Shiloh, restores things, the things that have been broken, and brings back the Shekhinah to his people. Shiloh can also be seen as a combination of the Hebrew particle shin, which is a contraction of the Hebrew word asher, which is the pronoun, what is that called? The pronominal, the who, what, which, where, that kind of pronoun. I forget the fancy grammar term for that. But it's a contraction of which or whom. And that's combined with the preposition lamed, with the third person singular possessive suffix lo. Thus, it can also be translated, that which belongs to him. And the meaning is that until he comes to that which belongs to him, or until that which belongs to him comes. This is how the Septuagint translates it. What's the Septuagint? It's the Greek translation of the Tanakh, of the Hebrew. It's called the Septuagint. It means 70. The idea is that 70, I think it's literally 72, rabbinical scholars were each isolated away from one another and told to translate the Hebrew Bible into Greek. And they did that, and when they met together, they all had the exact same translation to the T. Therefore, that supposedly proved its divine inspiration. And that became a very authoritative Bible among Hellenistic Jews that kind of were in the diaspora and disconnected, as well as it became the official, and still is the official, Old Testament for the Eastern Orthodox Church. And so the Septuagint understands and translates it this way. Shiloh is also a personal name that can be derived from the verb shalah, which means to rest. In the Messianic age, remember the whole idea of fractals? Well, the creation is a fractal of time itself. Each day of creation represents a period, an epoch in history that we live through, and culminates in the Shabbat, the rest, the eternal rest, you know. And so the Messiah is the one who brings rest, peace, Sabbath to the world. So which one is it? Now that we think like Jews and Hebraic thinkers, it's all of it. Okay? There's no either or, which one is it? And Hebraic thought, it's all of them. The trick is you have to find out how to reconcile all of them consistently. And this is why when people sometimes just crack open the Talmud and they read it and they're like, this book's a joke. Anyone who believes this is silly. Because it'll have 15 rabbis, all of them giving 15 different opinions, seemingly contradicting each one of them. And then that's the authoritative book of how they understand that. And you're like, how is that the authoritative book? Well, the trick is, how are all 15 reconciled? Once you can figure out how all those opinions are reconciled and all true at the same time, there's your answer. We in the West don't like thinking by heart. Okay. We would just assume the pastor tell us the correct answer, get it in black and white, and then anyone who doesn't agree with it can go somewhere else. And by the way, they won't be blessed like we are. Okay? So, Shiloh. Again, there's a lot more fodder with Shiloh. Lots of amazing things there with Shiloh. It is one of the names of Messiah and so forth. That's another understanding of it. But there are still more blessings. We have the blessings of Zebulon, and they precede Issachar, though Issachar is the older of the two. But why should we expect it to actually go in numerical order? On this account, the sages teach us that it is necessary to provide material means for those who study the Torah. This is a very important halachic point. Okay, I'm going to tell you why. Zebulon would be blessed with successful commerce. They would become the seafaring merchants, by which they would then provide Issachar, whom the sages have always understood as the Torah scholars, with material means so that they could dedicate themselves to study. In other words, Issachar, your day job is to study the Torah, and to study the Torah like nobody's business, and to teach it, and to apply it, to preserve it, to guard it, and Zebulon will take care of you. Modern Israel today, as a nation, still practices this. Ultra-Orthodox rabbis can be exempt from the mandatory military service that is required of all citizens, and they can receive government stipends so that they can study the Torah and run their yeshivas. Okay, so it still exists. And yes, you better believe it's a hot point. Okay, because non-observant Jews in Israel, what do you think they feel about that? Okay? But the rabbis' points are, this is the way it's always been in our people, and if we don't study the Torah, preserve it, and guard it, who is? And so it's a saying, it's rooted in the Torah. And this also exists in the church. Here at Emmanuel, we happen to call it Pastor Chad, okay? That is, I'm paid to study the scriptures. I mean, I'm paid to do it. You guys are crazy for paying me to do something I did for free, but I get paid to study the scriptures. I don't have to go out and work, a quote, a day job or find means and so forth. Emmanuel provides, you know, health coverage. They take care of me. But the exchange is, you better study scripture and you better teach it, okay? You know, that's the relationship. Okay, that's the relationship between Zebulon and Issachar. Now, having concluded the blessings upon Leah's six sons, Jacob now turns to the older son of Bilhah, Rivka's maidservant, leaving the blessing of Rachel's son for the last. Now, Dan, the tribe from whom Samson will come, is... is seen as the one who avenges the enemies of Israel. The final phrase, of which we will speak about more in a few minutes, is, "For your salvation do I long, O Lord." And this is understood by the sages to actually be the heartfelt prayer of Samson in his struggle against the Philistines. We're going to come back to that phrase. Then we have the blessing of Gad, Zilpah's older son, who went across the Jordan to fight for the land and retraced his steps only when the victory of the land had been achieved. Asher was promised agricultural bounty from which he would supply the king's table. Naphtali is said to be swift like a hind, and the sages note that in the war against Sisera, the swift warriors of Naphtali played the significant role in victory. And having completed the blessings over the sons of Rachel's handmaidens, Jacob now turns to bless the sons of Rachel. Joseph, he's already gotten two. Dad, come on. But his blessing is, you guessed it, and all the brothers rolled their eyes, lengthy and full of praise. He is described as a fruitful bough that grows tall and exceeds the wall of the garden. And Jacob actually evokes various names of God in blessing Joseph. Now remember, in Hebraic thought, names are not just names, okay? That's a Western invention. Names are more than names. They mean something. And this is especially true with the names of God, okay? And so Joseph gets many names of God invoked in Jacob's blessing of him. One of them is the Mighty One of Jacob. That reference to God, for as a name for God, is used only here and later in the poetic text of Isaiah and Psalms. So that tells you really should kind of ponder a little bit around there. Then Shepherd, then Rock of Israel. But Jacob doesn't use Zur for rock, T-Z-U-R. He uses Evan, E-V-E-N, Evan. And that's very, very important that he uses Evan. When we were in certain parashats about Jacob and we looked at Bethel, And we saw it foreshadowing what? That place in the ground. Okay, the temple. Mount Moriah. We encounter Mount Moriah and its foreshadowing. Where is Isaac bound? The Ikedah of Isaac. And Jacob has some encounters on here. And obviously later David and so forth will. Mount Moriah, the very crest of it, where it kind of flattens out. This is called the Heaven Steel, the foundation stone, but the Heaven. What's on that right now? It's the Temple Mount. And so here you have, again, a clear reference to God as being present on that mount, okay, by this reference to this name. It's a fractal reference to the temple. And then another name is the God of your father. And then another one is our favorite, Shaddai. Okay, what is Shaddai again? It isn't all-powerful, almighty, or however those English translations goof that up. Okay, what's Shaddai? The nurser, right? The only time Shaddai is usually invoked is when someone's barren. Right? And then there's soon to be children. It's the name you invoke when for fertility and fruitfulness and so forth. Then the blessing over Benjamin indicates that he is as a wolf who swiftly devours the prey. Israel's first king, Saul, would be a Benjamite. And in his brief reign, he conquered Moab, Edom, and Philistia. Mordecai and Esther are Benjamites who also helped defeat Haman. Can you think of another very bold and brash Benjamite? Yeah, Shaul of Tarshish, our good old friend Rav Shaul. Very much fits the profile of Benjamin. Okay, Paul didn't pussyfoot around. Okay. Now, waiting for salvation, Yeshua in the daily prayers of the Siddur. Okay, Siddur, what's the Siddur? It's the prayer book of Judaism. And the prayers in it, not all of them, but many of them, much of them, were established by the men of the Great Assembly around the time of Ezra. Again, not all of them, many of them. And through time, different ones have been added and edited and codified and so forth. But I've often told you, outside of the Bible, the best place to get to know Yeshua is the Siddur. You really want to, because you get to know what he prayed, how he prayed, when he prayed, and so forth. And also, surprise, surprise, you pray to Yeshua quite a bit in the Siddur. Okay, and we're going to learn a couple of those examples tonight. From Bereshit, Bereshit Rabbah, this is a Midrash. This is an oral tradition that existed at the time of Yeshua's life. Bereshit Rabbah, 98:14. It's a commentary on Genesis 49, verse 18. It says, "Our father Jacob foresaw Samson and thought that he was the Messiah. But when he saw him dead, he exclaimed, 'He too is dead.' Then for your salvation I wait / hope." We'll talk about that, O Lord. That's the quote from Genesis 49:18. "For your salvation I wait." Rabbi Yitzhak said, "Everything is bound up with waiting. Suffering is bound up with waiting. Martyrdom with waiting. The merit of the fathers with waiting. The desire of the world to come with waiting. Thus it is written in Isaiah," which is 26 verse 8, "Indeed, while following the way of your judgments, O Lord, we have waited for you eagerly. Your name, even your memory, is the desire of our souls." Now Jacob says this phrase in 49:18, "For your salvation, I wait," or "I hope, O Lord," near the time of his death. In the Siddur, there's a service called the Bedtime Shema. Guess when you say it. Okay. It doesn't mean you just say it in the evening. These are literally supposed to be the last words off your lips. Okay. There's evening prayer that's done in the evening. This is not evening prayer. This is the last thing. Now, for those who've been in our Siddur class, morning is resurrection, new life. So what do you think bedtime Shema focuses? Death. Going to sleep, right? We even use that metaphor for death sometimes. They've fallen asleep in the Lord. And so here we have Jacob near death. Now, one of the verses in the bedtime Shema, and you actually recite it three times in a row, and I'm going to recite it to you in Hebrew. It's Genesis 49, verse 18. But I want you to see if you can tell what it's really saying. So you're saying your bedtime Shema, and you come to this portion. Neshua teka kaviti Adonai. Neshua teka kaviti Adonai. Neshua teka kaviti Adonai. Whose name have I just invoked three times? I have just said in Hebrew, Yeshua, I am waiting for you, Lord. Yeshua, I am waiting for you, Lord. Yeshua, I am waiting for you, Lord. Lips of every Orthodox Jew, every night. Yeshua, I am waiting for you. Yeshua, I am waiting for you. Yeshua, I am waiting for you. Not the only place. Jacob exclaimed for Yeshua, I wait. Remember, he was given a glimpse. He saw it all. Thought it was Samson at first. No. He saw it, and then he said, Yeshua, I wait for you. The word translated salvation is Yeshua. Yeshua's name means salvation. The sages understood Jacob's exclamation to reflect his longing for the Messiah, the true judge of Israel, their true salvation. The daily prayer for the coming of the Messiah is based upon this passage. I'll give you another quick example. Three times a day in another prayer, a longer prayer known as the Amidah or the Shemona Esrei, the 18, Shemona Esrei means 18, 18 blessings, even though there's 19. You should know by now in Hebrew it never means what you think. But in the 15th blessing of the Shemona Esrei, we find this. Cause the branch, the Netzer, Nazarene, the one from Nazareth, of your servant David to blossom forth speedily and lift up his horn through Yeshua. For we wait for Yeshua every day. Blessed are you, Lord, who causes the horn of Yeshua to blossom forth. So I've just read two brief prayers, and this is the daily prayers. We have two of them. And we've invoked three times here in the 15th benediction, and we repeated it three times in Genesis, so 12 times we've invoked the longing for Yeshua. Okay. And the Siddur is full of that. It's full of that. So we go back to last week's discussion about the brothers and their intentional veiling of who Joseph is. Those brothers are praying, Yeshua, we long for you. Yeshua, we long for you. Crying, the wall, Western Wall, every day, risking their lives. Will he reveal himself to them? Or will their prayers go unheard? These words express the waiting, the longing, and the hope that is our expectation in Mashiach HaYeshua. Jacob's explanation reflects his longing for Messiah, the true judge and the true Savior. The Hebrew word that's translated here as wait, often, you know, Yeshua, I wait for you, I long for you, is kavah. But it can be translated also as hope. Messiah is the hope of Israel, and we hope for Yeshua, but we also wait for him. He is our hope of salvation, and it's not a passive waiting. It's not like we're passing time at the bus stop waiting for the bus to pick us up. It's a passionate waiting. It's a deep, heartfelt longing. It is an ache for his coming, for his appearing. That's the sense of urgency, and that's why in the bedtime Shema, it's repeated three times in a row. Okay, in Hebrew, when you wanted something in bold or italics, they didn't have the emphasis, and anything three times, big deal. Okay, in the Torah, you only get that Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Holy, holy, holy. Three times, huge deal. So beseeching that, it's amazing. To properly await Messiah, our hearts need to break with anticipation. Every day is, in some sense, painful because we're separated from our true love, our Dodi. one of the songs of the Shabbat is Lecha Doti. Doti is the term for beloved, you know, soulmate. But at the same time, it's also our hope of being united with Him that gives meaning to every day. The great Torah scholar Maimonides, the great Rambam, or as we like to say in Kentucky, the Rambam, says that a person who does not believe in Messiah and await passionately and eagerly for His coming denies the whole Torah. So perhaps the word kavah, wait, or hope is somewhat parallel to the conventional way we use our word faith. Our hope in Yeshua, our wait for Messiah, are components of our faith in Him. And in that respect, it is Jacob who declares, Yeshua taketh to meet thee, Adonai. Okay. So, get yourself a siddur if you don't have one. You get to know Yeshua very intimately. Because once you do, you'll see all kinds of things in the Gospels that are referencing these prayers. Havdalah, Mark chapter 1, that's why the demons can't get in the door. You'll know why they can't get in the door if you have a siddur, and so forth. So all kinds of things will be popping out. Acts chapter 2, most of the time the translation says, and they devoted themselves to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Naughty, naughty translation, folks. The Shemona Esrei, Amidah, the Amida, you know, however you want to go with it, also has another name. It's simply called the prayer. Now, Hebrew, like Greek and a lot of other languages, doesn't use the definite article unless it really means it. The is a definite article in the English, but we kind of fudge it around. Okay? The is a big deal. It sticks out like a sore thumb when they use it. So Acts chapter 2 actually says, and they devoted themselves to the breaking of bread, which is a Hebrew term for kiddush. So they devoted themselves to kiddush, the bread and wine before a meal, and to, and the Greek actually says, the prayer. The prayer. And so they devoted themselves to the Shemona Esrei. It tells us they said that three times a day. And the book of Acts also tells us they're in the midst of doing something and they stop what they're doing because why? It's the time of day to go pray. The time to go pray the Shemona Esrei. Okay, so all kinds of things are to start clicking and coming together and making a lot of sense that just aren't there unless that puts you in the culture. That puts you in the home of Mary, Joseph, and Yeshua. That's what they would have said around their table. Preparing for life after death. Genesis 47, 29 and 30 says, Jacob says, please do not bury me in Egypt, but when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. Where is their burial place? Machpelah, which is what? The cave inside the cave is the entrance into Gan Eden. Okay, we talked about that before. Now Jacob made his son Joseph swear that he would not bury him in Egypt, that he would be carried to the land of Israel and buried with his fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Machpelah, the cave. Jacob's insistence on being buried in the family tomb back in the land of Canaan indicates that even in death, he still was believing in the Abrahamic promises. And he believed the land of Canaan would one day belong to his children, and he wanted to be buried there. Moreover, he's actually displaying life, the belief in life after death. And that's what he means when he tells his sons, I am about to be gathered to my people. Genesis 49:29. Jacob anticipated being reunited with his forefathers. Now, some cynics will say that religion is just a crutch for weak-minded people who fear things and who fear death and want to make sense out of the unexplainable in the world. And sometimes, actually, that may be the case for some people. But it doesn't apply to those who study the Torah. Now, here is an important distinguishing factor of the Torah and much of modern evangelical Christianity. The Torah doesn't actually say very much about life after death. It talks a little, but not much. It's really not a book about how to get to heaven or what happens after we die. Modern evangelical Christianity is almost exclusively how to get from here to there. Okay? It's all about getting there. Judaism and the Torah, not so much so. And I know that's a shock to many of us because of where the church puts her focus. But it's not the focus of the Torah. The Torah is actually more concerned with how we live in this lifetime, not the next. In other words, if I came up to a typical Westerner and said, and I could prove it, and without a shadow of a doubt, they knew it was true. In 5 days, you're a goner. And then, you know, convince them and they knew it. The Westerner is going to be like, okay, well, I've got $20,000 on my limit on my visa. I'll max that out because I'll be dead by the time the statement comes. I'm going to call these people and know what I'm saying. I mean, we would, quote, eat, drink, and be merry because in 5 days we're dead. If you were to tell a Torah-observant Jew the same thing and they believed it, they wouldn't change a thing. They would still observe every mitzvah for that day because they're still alive now. And they still have to serve Hashem now. Their focus would still be right now. Because they would be like, hey, if 5 days Hashem's going to take me, then I can't do anything about it. I can do something about right now. And so the focus is the here and the now. Okay. So the Torah is not a book that focuses about the afterlife. That doesn't mean it doesn't believe it or teach it. It doesn't focus on it. There are clearly many hints and clues, and that's what they are. They're hints and they're clues that point to the afterlife and the resurrection of the dead. Once a Pharisee named Rabbi Samai was arguing with the Sadducees. Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection or an afterlife. And they said, well, prove to us from the Torah that the dead would be raised. I'm going to give you this example because it's going to first show you how a rabbinical argument from the Bible goes. And then I'm going to show you how Jesus uses the same rabbinical argument. So Jesus doesn't use the hermeneutics, the way to interpret the Bible, the way the church does. He uses the method of the rabbis, the pardes. Okay? So here's the argument. Rabbi Samai said, from where in the Torah do we learn of the resurrection of the dead? Well, from the verse, I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan. It does not say to give you, it says to give them. Therefore, since Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob haven't yet received the land, the resurrection of the dead is proved from the Torah. This is in the Talmud, Sanhedrin 90b. Rabbi Samai's point is that God had promised to give the land to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not just to their descendants. And as the writer of the book of Hebrews points out, the patriarchs died in faith without receiving their promises. So God must keep his promise, but in order to do so, he's going to have to raise these patriarchs from the dead to do it. And this explains why Jacob was so adamant about being buried in the tomb of his fathers in the land of Canaan. Now, I want to show you how Jesus uses the same logic, and it actually is coming from, because we're going to be in the Gospel of Mark, so it's going to be Peshat. Okay. The four levels of understanding, Peshat, basic, grammatical, historical, means what it says on the page. Remez means hint, what's being hinted at, what's between the lines. So when you read the book of Proverbs and it talks about scales weighing, being uneven and so forth, it isn't just talking about having faulty scales. You know, it's hinting at how you should be doing business or how you should deal with people and so forth. Darash is the homiletical, the moral, the ethical, the pulling out a nugget, a word, a unique phrase to try to apply this to your life in the here and now, the sermon. And then there's the sod, the mystery. This uses things like gematria, you know, where letters and numbers equal things. And hopefully if we have time, we'll hit on that tonight, one of these passages with the number 17. So we're going to deal with Jesus uses Peshat. By the way, these correspond to the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Luke, the Gospel of Matthew, and the Gospel of John. Okay, you read John like Peshat, you're going to get yourself in a no-no. This is why their chronologies don't always line up. This is why one has more details than the other. They're doing different things for different purposes. Peshat has seven rules. They're called the Midot of Hillel, the seven rules, the seven laws of Hillel. I won't list all seven of them for you. But Jesus is going to use one right here in Mark to prove the resurrection. And I want to see if you catch it. And see how they quote Scripture. It's not like we do. Okay? Jesus is again debating with Sadducees and stuff about the resurrection. They say, essentially, prove us from the Torah the resurrection. So from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 12, verses 26 and 27. But regarding the fact that the dead rise again, have you not read in the book of Moses, the Torah, here specifically Exodus 3, verse 6, and the passage about the burning bush? Notice how he gives it essentially a parashat title. He doesn't give you chapter and verse. How does he give you the chapter and verse? Tells you it's in the Torah, the burning bush. How God spoke to him, saying, I am the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And therefore Jesus says, he's not the God of the dead, but of the living. So, you come to me and say, prove to me from the Bible, Pastor Chad, the resurrection. And I say, that's really easy. Exodus 3 says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. End of discussion. How did I disprove the resurrection? By the way, it's a Loctite argument, rabbinically. Using one of these seven rules. All these have rules. Ramez has 13, the Rash has 32, so does 42. Well, when Moses encounters at the burning bush, that gives us some chronology. Are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, are they in the past on a linear time scale, or are they yet to come? Well, we're talking linear. Join me on Peshat, please. Join me on Peshat. We're in the seven rules of Hillel. They're in the past. They're dead and they're buried. But what does God say? I am. Not I was. Not I used to be. I am. Right now. Therefore, indicating Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob must somehow, in some way, still be alive, don't you? That's how Jesus proves the resurrection. And that's why he says he can make the statement, he's a God, not of the dead, but of the living, because he said, I am. Pure rabbinic argument. You don't know rabbinic exegesis? It looks like Jesus doesn't, that's not an impressive argument. If you know rabbinical exegesis, it's airtight. And I gave you an example from the Talmud, Sanhedrin, where that same method was employed. Okay, and that would have been an oral tradition that Yeshua would have studied. So he's a good student. So part of life is preparing for death, and part of preparing for death is preparing for life after death. Jacob prepared for death in full confidence because he had a relationship with the living God. And so Jacob, it's not expressly stated, but it's hinted. He's hinting at belief in the resurrection here. Just like Abraham was hinting at belief in the resurrection when he was willing to slice Isaac's throat. Why was he so willing to do that? Not just out of sheer obedience and fear of God, but because he believed God would raise him back from the dead. So it's implied. Okay, so the Torah certainly believes in life after death and resurrection, but its focus is right now. Okay? All right, we're going to have to skip like Ephraim and Manasseh. Sorry. It's brilliant stuff, but we're going to have to skip it. There's more stuff from the Siddur. Basically, I'll give you a real quick synopsis. In Kiddush, right before the Shabbat meal, you bless the children that are there. And for the girls, little girls, you bless them and essentially say, may they be like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, the matriarchs. But to the sons, to the little boys there, you don't bless them to be like the patriarchs, or at least it doesn't seem that way. You say, may you be like Ephraim and Manasseh. And so I'm just going to tie in and show how the blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh is the blessing of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because that's to whom the Abrahamic covenant goes to. And so Jacob does a beautiful thing. Judah gets Mashiach ben David, but Joseph gets the Abrahamic covenant. That's so He masterfully balances those, okay? And again, that's why the two brothers, Judah and Joseph, have that cantankerous relationship throughout history. That's why when those two can come together, nations and Judah, church and synagogue, then Messiah will be here. Now, so that was in a nutshell what I was going to give you. Trip in the Orchard, Part A's. I was also going to give you all four levels of the number 17, but I don't have time. So I'm going to give you a real quickie. A couple of weeks ago, Dr. Kelsch had asked about Jacob and his hardships and so forth, and somewhat addressed it in that he's a fractal of Israel as a whole. And so, like, Israel's had to go through many sufferings and trials and so forth, but finds ultimate vindication and so forth. We also have here, what was our Hebrew lesson? Jacob, what? Lived 17 years in Egypt. Okay, if I may give you a targum. Jacob had the best years of his life in Egypt. That's what that says. How did I get that? Okay. Tov. You might know this is Tav and Mazel Tov. Okay. Tov is good. But as you can imagine, a little more packaged than good. But 2 + 6 + 9, what does that equal?
17.
So Tov is 17. And so that's where we begin to see these years of Jacob's life were Tov. Because 17, remember I told you there were certain numbers and words that are kind of voted in verbal tallies? Tov is obviously one of these words. It's like grace and wisdom. It's a tally word. And 17, even in English and so forth, 17 is one of those numbers, one of those special numbers. If Tim Schrader, a local mathematician, were here, he could tell us maybe some cool things. What's one thing you know about 17? What goes into 17? What are its factors? It's a prime. Okay, that's one of the reasons it's very special. It's a prime. Okay, so in a nutshell, that's 17. It's good. And so it's telling us that these last years of Jacob's life, they were good. And so all the things he experienced leading up to that point, he gets to enjoy these last years of his life. Okay. And notice again the focus, like it was with Sarah when we read about Sarah's death. Remember, it really said, Sarah lived 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years. Sarah lived. And your English translations are like, Sarah died at 127 or something like that. But the end, it never says death. It says Sarah lived, and then it breaks it down 100 years. We talked about what the 100 was. And then it says 20 years. And then it says 7 years. And then it says again, Sarah lived. So the focus is on life, living here and now. Same with Jacob. These last 7 years, he lives. Tov. He lives good. All right, finally a little halacha carrying this out. Reuben was Jacob's firstborn son, in the natural pashat sense. The family assumed that Reuben was to be the main inheritor. But Jacob disqualified him from that position. He said in Genesis 49:4, "You shall not have preeminence because you went up to your father's bed and you defiled it. He went up to my couch." And he was referring to the incident in which Reuben shamefully slept with Jacob's concubine, Bilhah. And he described Reuben as uncontrolled as water, which is a poetic way of saying he lacked self-control and was therefore not worthy to receive the birthright. The book of 1 Chronicles summarizes Jacob's blessing over Reuben, saying, "Reuben was the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn." Okay. Repeated, so that's important. But because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel. There's where we get the Abrahamic covenant was passed to Joseph. So that he is not enrolled in the genealogy according to the birthright. 1 Chronicles 5. The tribe of Reuben never did hold preeminence in Israel. No kings or great leaders ever came from the ranks of Reuben. I guess we got the sandwich, but that's about it. Now, Jacob's blessing over Reuben reminds us of the dangers of sin. A person does not know what future opportunity he forfeits when he gives in to temptation. Spiritual potential, sparks, are extinguished each time we fail to stand firm against the desires of our flesh. There's a 2nd century BC writing called the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. And in fact, this gets adopted by the early church when it was still Jewish, by the way. It's called the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. And what this is essentially kind of like we read Jacob's last hours and so forth, and he was kind of giving his blessings. This is that for each of the 12 sons of Jacob. Okay? And Reuben is portrayed on his deathbed warning his sons against this. And I read to you from the Testament of Reuben in the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. The sin of promiscuity is the pitfall of life, separating man from God and leading on toward idolatry, because it is the deceiver of the mind and the perception, and it leads youths down to hell before their time. For promiscuity has destroyed many. Whether man is old, whether he's born rich or poor, he brings on himself disgrace among humanity, and he provides the devil with an opportunity to cause him to stumble. And so what you have here is just the warning of sin and its disastrous effects when we fail with our Yetzer HaTov to tame the Yetzer Hara, you know, when our evil inclination, our sinful nature conquers us. And like I said, the early church adopted this 12 Patriarchs, Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. It was very influential in the first couple hundred years of the church, as kind of their derash, their moral and ethical applications of the life of the people in the Torah. All right. Well, I know that was a lot. Again, like last week, I thought it was going to be short, and then I ended up keep writing and writing and writing guys my notes. So I know I blow a lot of steam and hot air at you guys. So hopefully some of it settles in. Any questions or comments? Quickly.
Is there a copy of your notes?
No. No. I don't release my notes for several reasons. One, they're not proof. They're full of errors. They're my shorthand. Two, unfortunately, in the past, people have used them against me. Like when I write something, like sometimes I forget to put a not, like Jesus is not this, and we know he is. People have actually tried to use that against me, that I'm teaching something false. And it's that happened way too many times for me to be comfortable just handing that out. And again, it's not like a book. It's my notes, my shorthand. My references, you know, my abbreviations. So I've been burned, and it would take a lot of time for me to smooth that out, to make it. Now, perhaps later in life, if I'm blessed with a great graduate assistant or something, I can give him my notes, and he can type them and proof them and smooth them out. And so forth, but no, I don't give out my personal notes. Yeah, I do keep it online, which again is enough in the Missouri Synod to get me in hot water enough. So yeah. Yeah, Dan.
I was wondering, you mentioned about the resurrection on the Sabbath, that this was
Sure. Well, it's because of what I did mention, because the Torah only deals with it not so much explicitly. The Sadducees were lovers of like Peshat, and so they would read, "I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob," and just kind of keep going. It's not as explicit as we might think it is. It doesn't mean it's not there. It is there. You see it also with David, when his child dies, he says, "Well, why are you not crying, King? You know, you were all upset when the child was sick. Now he's died. You've cleaned up." And he says, "Well, I know. I will be with him again." It's little snippets like that here and there, but it's never like just an all-out explosion Easter Sunday morning kind of exposition on it. And so they very much could, they could defend themselves by doing that, as well as the Sadducees were very much often, they would go to the kind of the highest bidder. They were very much, they would do Rome's bidding. In fact, Sadducees essentially, you know, when you talk to the rabbis today, Sadducees essentially become the Eastern Orthodox Church. That's why they, the Eastern Orthodox Church loves priesthood. I mean, whew, priesthood is the big deal. What was the big deal for the Sadducees? Priesthood. You look at a Eastern Orthodox bishop and all his regalia, what's he look like? He looks like the high priest in the temple. And even some of their doctrines, you'd be surprised at how much they're like the Sadducees. So when Rome really started cracking down and the Sadducees go undercover, and then Constantinople, which is the heart, still the capital, Istanbul, but still the capital of Eastern Orthodoxy, what emerges in Constantinople? The Eastern Orthodox Church.
So,
they've always been Rome's puppets. Yeah.
So the Sadducees are much like the churches today, right? They stay on the shot level. They stay in the
temple. Yeah, they would.
They don't make
sense. In that regard, they're also like modern day Karaite Jews, what are called Karaites. Mm-hmm. Stay exclusively on Peshat. Yep. In fact, many Orthodox Jews will call the Karaite movement in Judaism modern day Sadducee. Any other questions? All right, well, let us close with the blessing. Baruch atah Adonai, Noten HaTorah. Blessed are you, Lord, the giver of the Torah. Amen.